Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our weekly EAN podcast. My name is Barbara Tettenborn. I'm Editor-in-Chief of E-Learning of the European Academy of Neurology. My today's guest is Dr. Thomas Meinl. He is a clinician scientist, attending physician and group leader at the Bern Stroke Research Center at the Inselspital in Bern in Switzerland. His focus is on the interface between neurology and cardiology. He is running prospective studies on stroke in patients on anticoagulation, covert brain infarction, and cardiac imaging for etiological stroke workup. Today we will talk about hidden hazards in stroke and dive a little bit into covert cerebrovascular disease. So hello and welcome, Thomas.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
My first question directly focuses on the title. What do you mean by covert cerebrovascular disease? How frequent is it in comparison to manifest stroke, and how do you detect it if it is covert?
Thank you, Barbara, for the interest in the topic. So what do you mean by covert cerebrovascular disease? So cerebrovascular disease, as you know, is a vascular disease affecting the brain. And covert in this sense means that it does not cause the typical stroke symptoms. So if we have a stroke occurring in an eloquent brain area, typically patients report sudden onset unilateral weakness, sudden vision problems, sudden speech problems. But if the vascular damage occurs in a non or less eloquent brain territory, then patients lack those typical symptoms and they will not seek medical attention. And apart from those focal lesions, covert cerebrovascular disease also includes small vessel disease, which is a more diverse, more widespread affection of the small vessels within the brain. How frequent is it? So in the research cohorts, it's about 10 to 30% of people, elderly people. In our clinical system, it's about 20 to 30% of all MRI scans that show covert cerebrovascular disease, including small vessel disease and focal post-ischemic brain lesions. So it is very frequent. It is actually estimated to be around 3 to 4 times more frequent than manifest stroke, which, you know, is already a very common disease.
But you actually detect it by chance. I mean, you must have to do some MRI and the neurological workup without really clinically seeing any signs or symptoms in the patient. So what kind of patients are these, and what are the phenotypes then of men and women who actually come to these MRI investigations to find out that you do have a covert cerebrovascular ischemia?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So the MRI scan is usually done for a completely different reason, whether it's a control, for example, of an aneurysm, whether it's a research MRI, whether it's an MRI that was done for vertigo with the final diagnosis of BPPV, for example. So there are a lot of MRI scans. Actually, it is estimated that in OECD countries, we have about 80 MRI scans per 1,000 inhabitants done. And many of those include the brain structures, and they are not necessarily done for suspicion of stroke. I'm not talking about those scans. I'm talking about those scans that are done for a completely different reason, and incidentally, you find those post-ischemic brain damage. And the phenotypes that you can find, they include phenotypes of small vessel disease, so lacunar phenotypes. They can be acute or chronic, and they can be of embolic phenotypes involving the cortical structures or large cerebellar infarctions, for example.
So it's a full scale of cerebrovascular disease really representing. And do you have an idea why these are asymptomatic? Is it because of the size of the lesion? Obviously not. You just said that there can be large cerebellar lesions, or is it more, which is probably the case, due to the location?
Yeah. So there have been studies In small vessel disease, but also in embolic phenotypes. And not very surprisingly, the ones that did not cause typical stroke symptoms were outside of the main sensory and motor tracts. So they affect brain regions, which are less eloquent in the sense of typical symptoms, which are frontal lobe, parietal lobe, but also the infratentorial regions and the cerebellum that are surprisingly not very eloquent in many people. Or they are causing symptoms that are not necessarily thought to be related to ischemic stroke.
Are covert strokes often associated with manifest strokes, or the other way around? Do patients with manifest strokes often have additional covert clinically silent strokes?
So from research cohorts, we already know since decades that people that have a covert brain infarction at baseline, they have a roughly 2 to 3-fold higher risk of a manifest stroke during follow-up. And there is very elegant work from David Kent in Boston, which within the clinical system, using natural language processing, they extracted clinically obtained MRI scans, which patients did have covert infarcts, and you see exactly the same. So the one in the clinical system without stroke that have covert brain infarcts at baseline, they have a 3-fold increase in manifest stroke over the follow-up period. So yes, people with covert infarcts, they are at increased risk of stroke. And we also know that stroke patients acquire covert lesions over follow-up, and many research projects now use MRI scans to make use of that, because it is a very good surrogate parameter that you can also use, for example, in COMPASS, it was used as a surrogate covert lesions during follow-up.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting, yeah. So you use it more and more by doing all the imaging to find out if people have both manifest and covert strokes. We do have treatment standards for the secondary prevention of stroke after a manifest stroke in patients with a clinically overt stroke. But how should a patient be handled who has signs of one or several clinically silent strokes just in imaging? And do they need the same workup as patients with clinically manifest stroke? I suppose yes, but I would like to know better. And what about medical or other treatments?
Yeah, that's the tricky part, actually, because here we do have a clear lack of evidence. So it's very surprising, given the fact that covert lesions are about 3 times more frequent than manifest stroke. There is very little evidence and no study actually addressing this specific patient population. Everything we know for manifest stroke, whether it's antithrombotic treatment, lipid-lowering treatment, blood pressure control, we don't know this for covert lesions. We don't know this if we use the same diagnostic approach. Should we screen for atrial fibrillation? Should we obtain an echo? If you are interested, there is a very good scientific statement from the American Stroke Association published in 2017 from Eric Smith and colleagues. They dive into the available evidence, and there's very few. And they basically say you should use common sense. So if the covert lesion looks embolic, you should check the vascular image of the head and neck vessels. You should obtain echocardiogram, and you should screen for AF. But actually, we don't know if this benefits the patient, but it's certainly equipoise regarding whether we should be diagnostically and therapeutically aggressive, yes or no.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So, yeah, common sense in medical treatment is very, very wide and open and can be different from one doctor to the other. So if a certain patient goes to the one doctor and then to the other one, they might get two completely separate recommendations regarding workup and treatment.
Yeah, I agree. And we queried this actually with the help of ESO and also EAN. We distributed a survey to expert stroke physicians, how they would manage. We sent out one case example of a small vessel disease lesion and one of an embolic lesion. And there was large heterogeneity. Some physicians, they were saying, no, this is an incidental finding and I would do nothing. Whereas the majority was quite proactive as well for diagnostics, as well for therapeutic management. But there is heterogeneity, and what I always do is I ask the patient, look, we found this. We know that it increases your risk. We know that it is linked to vascular risk factors, including AF. What's your opinion? Should we invest in screening for AF, for example? I counsel them on the pros and cons of starting lipid lowering and antithrombotics. And then we reach a shared agreement. And obviously, in where there is no firm evidence, I think it's wise to also include the patient perspective.
Yeah, I think that's probably a very good recommendation. I just last week I had a patient, 45-year-old, and she had an MRI for a completely different reason. And then there was one spot which was from the neuroradiologist thought it could be an old ischemic lesion. And then she came to the neurologist asking, "Yeah, what shall I do with it?" And so I found it difficult. So it's very nice to have this topic today, because then I can really recommend her something next week. I decided she has no risk factors, is slim, is sportive, and there's this one lesion. It could be something else, but no other one. So I find it difficult how to handle these patients in a single case, and especially if it's only one lesion. If you have separate lesions, then it's probably easier. But with one lesion, it gets difficult. But I decided to do a workup. It probably depends where in the world you are, how much you can afford to do a full workup, or if the insurance company pays for it, and so on and so on. I think that could probably be a factor. But it would be nice to have a standardized program as well. So are there, you mentioned that there are almost no studies available so far. Are there any studies ongoing currently to get more knowledge on these clinically silent covert strokes?
Yeah, I think the community now realizes the importance to bring all this knowledge that we have from the epidemiology studies really to clinical practice. And we started a couple of years ago where we said, let's start really caring about those patients, stop ignoring them. And we started a referral pathway from neuroradiology. So if we see such lesions on MRI scans, we have a referral to our outpatient clinic. We have a dedicated outpatient clinic for COVID cerebrovascular disease. We counsel the patients, and the one that agree, we run a full stroke workup upon, and we collect those in a prospective registry. And for the subgroup with older age and increased risk for AF, we also use implantable cardiac monitors to answer the question, what's the yield of rhythm monitoring in such patients? So there are studies. I think what we need is a network of clinics dedicated to covert cerebrovascular disease, because in the pipeline, there are several very powerful potential treatment options, including, for example, the LACI-2 regime. But first, we need to see the patients in dedicated outpatient clinics, and then we can also address them specifically in trials. And I think we definitely need more trials on this specific population.
We do have the European Academy of Neurology Brain Health Strategy, and just 2 weeks ago we had the kickoff of the Swiss Brain Health Strategy, which goes into the direction of prevention of neurological diseases. And I mean, these patients with covert cerebrovascular disease would be probably the perfect ones for trying to prevent a manifest stroke. Is it somehow included in this brain health initiative?
It was started before the Brain Health Initiative was launched, but it certainly fits perfectly in the scope of it, because it addresses patients that are at high risk for detrimental brain health outcomes. It's not only about manifest stroke. We know that small vessel disease, it includes frailty, it includes mobility problems, it includes dementia, it includes mood disorders. So it's really a potpourri of symptoms and manifestations. And our hypothesis is that if we identify those high-risk patients early, we counsel them, and we manage to optimize the risk factor profile, then we can largely contribute to healthy aging. And I think it's not only about medical treatment. I think it's also about, you know, encouraging exercise, eating healthy, stop smoking. I think all of those factors are really much more easy to achieve once you can prove to the patient that already end organ damage has occurred. It's not about frightening the patients, but it's about motivating them for easy behavior changes And from my experience, it's really facilitates to optimize the risk factor profile of the patients.
Yeah, thank you very much for these last points, bringing up that the patient actually can do a lot themselves to improve their healthy aging and their better living in older age. But in daily life, I really find out that it's very difficult to persuade them to have a better lifestyle, to do more sports, to be more active, to eat healthier, and so on. So I think we do have a lot of work to do to persuade everybody in the world, not only the two of us. I think we are doing quite well already, but all the other ones, to stick to the brain health strategy and to improve the living in older age in the end. So I think that's all our goal. We get elder all the time, but we want to be healthy in old age, and that's what we all can do. So thank you for all your contributes to this topic. It was a very, very interesting talk. Thank you very much. Anything you want to add in the end? Or
I call my fellow listeners and neurologists to think about, how do you handle this? And for example, one thing that always strikes me, if incidentally you find an acute lesion, then in many hospitals, people are sent to the ED, they are sent to the stroke unit, they are taken care upon as we would for a manifest stroke. But if we find a chronic lesion, we just ignore it. And I think this is really a bit schizophrenic. And I think people should start thinking, okay, how is this handled in my institution? If I order an MRI for headache, what do I get back? Do I just get back no reason for headache, or do I actually look in the text whether there are cortical gliosis or, you know, covert lesions of post-ischemic phenotype? And should I start seeing those patients? Should I start caring? We decided it is about time. And I think the community is moving in that direction. And I would encourage my colleagues, because it's very worthwhile. And I think we can prevent morbidity and mortality by this approach.
Very good last statement. Thank you very much for this nice talk. Have a nice day.
Thank you, Barbara.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.